This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're not going to deal with the entire chapter this week, but we will deal with the first part of it. It would be good, though, if you read through the entire chapter so that you have it in perspective. The part that we're going to deal with is this impassioned plea on his part for acknowledgement that he owes them nothing. I appointed a king as you asked me to. Here he is, and I'm an old man, and he's not really old, as we said, he's only a man of 50. That is implying I have aged in office. I have had a difficult life. I've lived under enormous pressure and enormous constraints, difficulties. I've travelled around all my life. I have aged in office. Uvonai hinam itchem, in verse 2. And my sons, they are with you. Meaning they're not one of us, they're one of you. I haven't even had the time to raise my children the way I would have liked to. My efforts have been completely towards the community, outward. I've done very little for my own family. So, for myself, I haven't spent time at the spas and at the gyms. I'm old. My children, they're neglected. They're one of you. They don't even have the levels of education that would be fitting for children of mine. My life has been leading you from my early days, from my youth, until now. And we know to what extent that is true, that from his birth, virtually, he was in this position. He didn't have a normal life, and that's what he's saying. I was deprived of a normal life in my dedication to you. Then he says in verse 3, Hineni anuvi neged Hashem veneged Mashiach. I want you to answer me in front of God and in front of his anointed one, King Saul. Eshor mi lokachti v'chamor mi lokachti. Whose ox have I ever taken? Whose donkey have I ever taken? Says the Medrash on that. Abba Bar Kahana said, Koshe hu hagezel. Theft is a very severe thing. Sheshnei gedolei olam, because two of the greatest people that ever lived, Moshe and Shmuel, nitzrichu lihisfakeach olav, found it necessary before they died to clarify to the people they served that there wasn't any thought, any possibility of even the slightest bit of theft. That had to be clarified. That's how serious theft is. All the other things he doesn't deal with them. Have I done this? Have I done that? Those are all different issues. But theft he deals with very, very precisely. Both him and Moshe. Moshe amar lo chamor echod mem nasasi. Moshe declares, I never took one donkey of this. And then the rabbis ask, Chazal ask, Mi eniach Moshe lekapchonim veleganovim? What is Moshe saying? I didn't take one of their donkeys. Do we suspect that he was a thief? What is Shmuel saying? Did I ever take one of your oxen? Was he a thief? Was he a robber? What was he? What's there to pride yourself of? The man who's the greatest moral authority of his generation gets up at the end of his life and says, you know what? I never committed car theft. I didn't take anybody's automobile. I didn't oppress anybody. Big deal. Is that such a statement of morality? So that cannot be what he means. Elo amar Moshe, what was Moshe saying? Beshoshi Yisrael misnoedidin mimasa lemasa. When the Jews were moving from camp to camp through the desert, there was movement, there was travel. Lo yomarti leechod mem tol kli ze beyotcho. What he means is, I never said to one of you, can you carry my suitcase for me? Can you put it on your cart? That's what he means. I never asked you to do me a favor, not even that your ox should carry one of my suitcases. I never even asked that. We were traveling all the time. It's normal. People are traveling. Can you carry this for me? Have you got space for this for me? I never did that, said Moshe, in the 40 years that we traveled together. There's nobody of you among the 2 million people here, or 3 million people, that can ever remember an occasion when I asked one of you to carry one of my things in your property. I packed my own suitcases. I unpacked my own suitcases. I loaded my own suitcases. I unloaded my own suitcases. I never asked you for help in all that time. For one who travels, that's not so easy. To always pack your own suitcases and unpack your own suitcases. Not so easy. But he did. Omer Rabbi Yochanan adds, Godol hador b'sha sholeich la'asos tzorchi tzibur. When the leader of a community is doing, he's on public business, not traveling on vacation, he's on public business. The president is on public business. Mimu tzorich litol achamor, whose vehicle does he drive? Whose motor car does he drive? Lo mishot tzibur, doesn't the government give him a car? B'ram hocho v'yikach Moshe es ishtu v'esbonot, but not Moshe. No government vehicle, no government property, no government assistance. He financed his own office. They didn't even pay for his traveling expenses. He wouldn't allow them to pay for his traveling expenses. Omer Rabbi Yossi, Oshir Godol Hayah Shmuel. Rabbi Yossi adds, Shmuel was a very wealthy man. She'ilu tevaoy miyodo, because he says a dangerous thing. He says here in front of these thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, have I ever taken anything of yours? What would he have done if somebody would have said, yes, Shmuel, once you did? What would Shmuel have done? Immediately he would have repaid. He would have said, you claim that I took an ox. How much was it worth? You can't make a statement like this if you're not going to pay. What are you going to get into? An argument with him backwards and forwards and say, bring witnesses, and let's get the press here and the televisions get going, and Shmuel's in an argument with, say, it would never happen. One wouldn't be so idiotic as to raise such a thing if you're not ready for a mischief maker. And a Jewish leader surely understands that in that kind of community there are going to be a few mischief makers. Who would be able to resist the opportunity to be able to say, when Shmuel declares, have I ever taken anything of yours, for some idiot to put up his hand and say, yes, Shmuel, I'm sure you've forgotten, but I haven't. You remember such and such a time? And what would Shmuel say? Shmuel, says the Gemara, would have immediately put his hand into his pocket and paid whatever the person wanted to pay. So they would have gotten rid of that one. So he must have been very wealthy to make these comments. Eshor mi lokachti. So what does he mean when he says, did I take anybody's ox? Shosho yisi makriv lekorban aseim umavakesh rachamim aleihem. Even when I took an ox to bring as a sacrifice, to ask God to forgive you, whose oxen did I use? I used my oxen, not yours. I paid for the ox. When it came to anointing the king, I paid for all of that. And you remember Shmuel didn't have an office. Shmuel didn't have a courtroom in a centralized place. He used to go from village to village. Who paid for the traveling? Who provided the transport? I used to do it. Why is this so important? And why did they go out of their ways not to take something that is so legitimately theirs? The Midrash starts off by saying theft is a terrible thing. And then it says, this isn't theft. They weren't saying, Moshe wasn't saying, I never stole a donkey from you. Shmuel wasn't saying, I never stole an ox from you. What they were saying is, on government business, I never used government funds. I never used public money. I never used public transport. I paid for it all myself. That was Moshe and that was Shmuel. Why is that so important? And why is that equated to theft? Implying, and if I would have used public money and public transport, that would have been similar to theft. I never did it. What's the similarity? In what way is that theft? It's perfectly legitimate. I'm going to read to you an amazing piece of Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish was an exceptional rabbi who only died about 40 years ago, if that. He lived in Israel. He was virtually unknown until his 40s or 50s. But sat and learned all those years. And then emerged as one of the greatest Talmudic authorities of his time. And one that we still refer to enormously in most issues. And he writes the following. In a section where he defines and describes the enormous integrity of rabbinic scholars of that time, of Talmudic time, how their entire training was one of not allowing any form of self-interest or even mere intuition to deflect the accuracy of their thinking. And he brings many, many examples of that. How absolutely honest and clear their thinking was, irrespective of its impact on themselves and irrespective of their background and so on. And then he says, "V'hinei ein hazhoros hashochad b'chlal hamishpotim." If these Talmidei Chachamim, these sages, are of such enormous standards of integrity, why is the Torah so concerned about bribery? Why is a judge not allowed to take a gift from somebody who's judging? And he says, this is not a mishpat, that's not a logical. Logically, there should be no reason why a judge cannot accept a gift from one of the parties. He argues. Elo michlal akukim, this is one of the things that's almost without rational explanation. And he goes on to prove his argument. He says, Shaharei lo osra toiro feiro la'atzma. The Adam Raya trait on that. In the old days, if an ox was found to be non-kosher, that was a severe financial loss. Because the non-Jews didn't eat ox. They only ate pork in Europe. So when a rabbi used to get a shiloh, the butcher would call the rabbi in and say, I've got a problem with an ox. The shochet has slaughtered an ox, and it seems to have some kind of disease in the lung. We're not altogether sure. The rabbi would go to the butcher and check the ox out. The cow, whatever it was, it was slaughtered. If he found it was trade, that was an enormous hardship for the poor butcher. Because those oxen were incredibly expensive, the villagers were very poor, and that could put him out of business. What happens if the rabbi himself is the butcher? Is he allowed to make his own decision on his own ox? If it could put him out of business for life. Imagine a rabbi who has a few daughters to marry, a few sons to educate, and he's invested all the money he's got into an ox because he hears the price of meat is going up. And this is going to pay for his whole future, this is his whole pension, this is his retirement fund, this is his children's dowry, this is everything. And finally the price does go up, and he's ready, and he sells the ox. And the butcher says, sure, I'll buy the ox, but I want a guarantee from you. If it's trade, you refund. I must say, sure, it's fair enough. They shift the ox, and the butcher says, I'm not so sure I'm happy with this ox. Just check it out for me as a kosher. Is the butcher entitled to say, I want another opinion? Is the rabbi allowed to make that decision on his own? Says the chazanit, of course he is, absolutely. We trust him. But he will look at it absolutely honestly, and he'll make a decision. Imagine a situation, there have been such cases, these examples I'm giving you, where a rabbi has to decide he's invested his money in a shipload of whiskey. And before Pesach, he forgets to sell it. Imagine what that's worth. And now the question is, after Pesach, is he allowed to get any benefit from it? Can he make that decision himself, or does he have to refer it to an objective authority? No, he can make the decision himself. His training is such that those kind of judgments he knows how to make. And we judge him completely as being able to make those judgments objectively. And at least we judge him well enough to know that if he can't, he'll back out of it himself and say, I'm not thinking straight in this one, I need another opinion. If he feels confident in judging himself, he's fully entitled. So says the Chazon Ish, we see that we're not afraid of rabbis, of the caliber that a rabbi had to be in order to be given these positions today. It's nothing. Anybody can become a rabbi. Today you don't even need honesty to qualify, certainly not knowledge. But in those days you needed
In those days, you still needed both knowledge and honesty. Otherwise, there was no way that you could qualify. The stringent character requirements were such that to get through the process of even becoming a rabbi, never mind being appointed to a rabbinic post, was such there's no way you could make it. If there wasn't absolute intellectual honesty in the way you thought, not just in the way you acted, but in the way you thought, that was the most important part. Maharishi Yeshiva used to say, as many others also, they can teach somebody anything, but they can't teach a crooked person to think straight. And therefore they would eliminate the crooked people. They would identify them. They were very, very skilled at identifying a student who was a crooked thinker. And you used to see, by the way, the Rosh Hashiva would treat him very early on, that this was somebody who had to be abandoned somewhere along the way, that there wasn't any investment in him, whatever. I saw my Rosh Hashiva invest in naughty boys. I saw very naughty boys. I saw him invest in boys who didn't know very much. I saw him invest in boys who came from poor and ignorant backgrounds. But I never saw him invest in a crooked thinker. Not even a minute. So to get to the point of making it through a yeshiva process in those days, to get to the point of graduating from a yeshiva process, of being admitted for rabbinic training, of being trained, of being accepted for examination, of passing that examination, and then still of being appointed to a rabbinic post, and certainly to one where you're judging and making these kinds of decisions, no chance could be somebody who wasn't thinking straight. So we trust him. So why are we worried about whether he judges in a case where he's had some benefit from one of the parties over here? And it goes so far as to say that even there's a strange thing. That the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was not allowed to give evidence in certain cases of establishing the timing of the new moon, because that could affect the temperature during Yom Kippur. And he had an interest in making Yom Kippur as early as possible, so that it wouldn't be too cold, because he had to walk around on the base of Mikdash barefoot, it wasn't pleasant. And there was a feeling that even that, to give evidence about the timing of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we didn't allow the Kohen Gadol to do, because he had an interest. If we trust these people, if we trust their integrity so completely, why should that be an issue? He didn't really deal with the answer. He says this is one of the statutes. But there's another magnificent piece of rabbinic writing that goes back much longer. This is from the Rambam's teacher. So this goes back to about the 10th century. Even the Rambam had a teacher. And his name was the Rigi Gash. And this is brought in the Shittim Kubetis in Borakana, the Chosov Talmid Echot Mitalmide Arab Rabbeinu Yosef Halevi Ibn Gash. There was a Talmud who wrote the following in the name of the Rigi Gash. I'm here to read it to you because it's so beautiful. Translated from Arabic. He quotes the Gemara that says, Biro de Shatis Mine Gotir Mi Bei Kal. If you've drunk from a well, don't throw a stone into it. It's a phrase in many languages, many cultures, we've got it in the Gemara. Now, what does that mean? Don't do bad to something from which you benefit. And this doesn't not talking only about wells and things, it's talking about life. Shemisha bala mimeno ezatoeles, or nene. That if a person has had any benefit whatever from any source, is improper to do any action the outcome of which could be disadvantageous for the source from which you've benefited. If one has benefited from any source, one should not commit any act the outcome of which could be disadvantageous for the source of one's benefit. That's what that statement means. And the Gemara brings many examples of this. For example, from the plagues of Egypt. Why some of them were done by Aaron, not by Moshe? When the earth had to be hit, Aaron did it, not Moshe. When the water had to be struck, Aaron did it, not Moshe. Why, the Gemara says? Because Moshe benefited from the water. The water protected him when he was a baby. Moshe benefited from the earth. The earth covered up those Egyptians that he killed and buried. The Egyptian that he killed and buried. And he was able to hide them long enough to flee. So he had benefit from the earth. It was improper for him to strike the earth. Can the earth feel it? Probably not. That's not the issue. The immorality is not the feeling of the other party. The immorality is in the action itself. To perform a negative action, a damaging action, irrespective of the outcome of that action, but to perform an action which is negative and damaging on something from which you've benefited, even something inanimate, is not in order. Our teacher told the story about the Rif. So the Rif's student was the Rimi Gash, and the Rimi Gash's student was the Rambam. That was the chain. But he had a case where he had to go to court with somebody, and he was supposed to judge on a case with somebody, and he didn't accept it. And that the story was simply that he was once ill, and he needed to go to a spa, and he went to a particular spa. The owner of the spa later on, and he healed, he was healed while at that spa. The owner of the spa got into bad times and had to sell the spa, and there was an argument about the amount that had to be paid, and various things around the spa, and the Rif said, I'm not sitting on this case. That in sitting on a case, one might have to find against, one will have to find against one of the parties. One might have to find against the party from which one's benefited. And one doesn't want to be put in that position. So we have many cases in the Gemara where great sages recuse themselves from cases where they had received minor benefits. Somebody once given them a gift. Years later, they're sitting in court, and the two litigants come in, and one of them is the person that once gave them a box of chocolates for a shot. And there are cases in the Gemara, it's not legally required, but there are cases in the Gemara where the judge has said, sorry, I can't sit on this case. I once received a box of chocolates from this person, I can't. Another case, a judge has to recuse himself, I can't sit on this case, why not? One day I was walking across a very rickety bridge, and I wasn't steady, and I was about to fall, but this man supported me and helped me walk across the bridge. I can't sit on this case. And then she said, what are we worried, that these people are going to not be able to think straight? Are we worried that because they got a box of chocolates for Rosh Hashanah 10 years ago, that they're not going to be honest in the way they weigh up the signs? That's not the issue. What these judges foresee is, I might have to find against the person who gave me a gift, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to be in that position. I don't ever want to be in a position, no matter how justified it is. When Moshe had to hit the water to turn the water into blood, that was a great thing. God told him to do it. It was to save the Jewish people. It was to impact on the Egyptians. It was a great event. But Moshe couldn't do it. Aaron had. When Moshe had to hit the earth to bring the lice, the killing, a great thing that caused the Jews ultimately to be released from Egypt. Moshe couldn't do it. Aaron had to do it. Because no matter what the reason, to do something against a source of benefit is one of the prime acts of immorality. Now, if we were to say, what is the starting point of morality? Then I would suggest that the starting point of morality is recognition of indebtedness. That would be the starting point. Then you move further than that. But if a person doesn't recognize indebtedness, then morality doesn't start with him. Then there's no way they can be in the relationship. If a person doesn't feel uncomfortable with indebtedness and want to reciprocate, then no morality can really start. So the very beginning of morality is to recognize indebtedness. But the first step of recognizing indebtedness is not reciprocate. That's the second step. There's a step before reciprocate. And that's just don't do harm. Don't hurt him. That's all. And that's why when the non-Jew came to Hillel and said, teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one leg, what did Hillel say? Don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. He didn't say love your neighbor as you love yourself. It's more basic, it's more fundamental not to damage than it is to do kindness. That the starting point is just don't damage, don't do harm. Imagine what a world we would be living in if people didn't do any good for each other. They never helped each other. But they didn't damage each other either. Can you imagine what a beautiful world that would be? Nobody ever caused anybody else any damage. Nothing. Not financial damage, not verbal damage, not emotional damage. Nothing. No damage. No kindness, no chesed, no charity, but no damage. It would be a wonderful world. The problem is there's a lot of charity and there's a lot of kindness. So why is the world in a mess? Because as much charity and kindness is, there's at least as much damage. Damage with one hand, but charity with the next hand. And we look at the charity and say, look how great we are. And we don't realize that sometimes at the moment of giving the charity, we're destroying the other person. You give it to him in a way that makes him feel bad. You give it to him in a way that is cheap. You don't show respect while you're giving it to him. Or while you're giving him the charity, you're yelling at your child. Charity with the one and destruction with the other. Forget the charity, just don't destroy it. Much better not to destroy than to give charity. Much better not to destroy than to do kindness. Doing kindness is wonderful, but anybody can do that. Every nation does kindness. Every religion talks about doing kindness. What everybody doesn't emphasize is that it's more important not to do to others what you wouldn't want done to yourself than it is to love them. That's the first step of love. That's the first step of any kind of morality. And if not doing damage is the first step of morality, then there's one step even before not doing damage. And that's at least don't do damage to people who've done you good. At least that. And you might think that's very obvious. But it isn't. Because if you look carefully, and unfortunately you don't even have to look at the person sitting next to you to figure this one out. If you look carefully, the people we sometimes damage the most are the people we've received the most from. We don't like being indebted. We resent it. And when we are indebted, we sometimes shtechlen, without even knowing. Sometimes subconsciously. Children to parents, husbands and wives, people who close, people who owe one another something, are sometimes the worst of friends. It's much easier to be friendly with somebody you don't owe anything to. Much easier to be friendly with somebody who you don't owe your life to. It's an uncomfortable feeling to owe your life to somebody. And when one does, one wants to get away from it. I think I've mentioned to you that there's a wide held view that when a rabbi makes somebody religious, that person usually turns against that rabbi at some point. One sees it very, very often. He doesn't want to constantly be with a guy who remembers him before he became religious. He's not very prudent. And he doesn't want to look at the rabbi on Shabbos, and the rabbi looks at him and says, I remember when on Shabbos you were driving your Harley Davidson around the place. He doesn't want to see that. To get away from him. He wants to be with a rabbi whose first meeting with him, he already had a long beard. Looked respectable already. That's what he wants to be. We don't like engaging with people in whose presence we feel vulnerable. And when somebody else has saved us, when somebody else has helped us, we feel vulnerable in their presence. And we tend to get quite harsh in our dealings with those people. And that's the first step of morality. So if we go through morality and we say morality is doing kindness and chesed and tzedakah, charity and kindness, yes it is. But there's something more basic than that. And that is, don't damage people. Morality is not damaging people. There's something more basic than that. When somebody's done you good, reciprocate, do him good. If reciprocating somebody who's done you a favor is good, is morality, there's something more basic than that. Just don't harm people who've done you good. But there's one step even more basic than that. And that is, don't even harm something that's done you good. Not only someone. Even something. Don't harm. And in truly religious homes, children are educated that way. sometimes a little kid will trip over a chair, and the kid will want to hit the chair, you know,
bad chair, naughty chair.
In a truly religious home, a father will say, don't you hit that chair. You've been sitting on that chair. That chair's been making you comfortable. You trip because you're the idiot. You're clumsy. Don't hit the chair. And we'll say, what's that whole debate about? What's that discussion? We're talking about chairs. No, we're talking about a moral reaction. Because the kid who hits the chair when he's small and gets irritated because he fell and isn't able to say, I fell because I was clumsy. I fell because I didn't see the chair. I'm the problem. And puts the problem onto the chair. That kid grows up doing the same with people. It's a way of looking at yourself. It's not a way of looking at chairs. It's a way of relating to your environment. And in a truly religious home, a child starts getting educated that way from very small. That chair's done you good. Don't hit that chair. Those animals, those people who have pets, the child wants to hit the dog because the dog bit the animal, bit the child. The dog bit you because you were teasing him. That dog protects us. That dog barks when somebody comes near the house. You don't hit that dog. That dog's doing us good. And the child is trained to notice when I owe something. And you start looking around. I owe the chair something. I owe the table something. I owe the house something. I owe the dog something. What don't I owe? And what about my parents, my brothers, my sisters? And what about God? Then morality starts. But when you're hitting the chair and you're kicking the dog, you're yelling at the parents and you're shouting, then where's God? It's everything or nothing. You're either going to look at the whole world as a place to which you're indebted, or you're going to look at the whole world as a place that is indebted to you. And God's part of that world. There are those who look at the world, including God, as a source from which to take, and those who look at the whole world, including God, as a source from which I have taken and to whom I am indebted. And these rabbis weren't prepared to sit in judgment over somebody from whom they'd taken, because it might require them to be harsh in that judgment, and they didn't want to be in that position. That explains the Rimi Gash, the answer to the Chazon Ish's question. The reason a rabbi isn't allowed to judge in those cases is not because we suspect, we worry that he might be dishonest. The reason is we don't want to put him in a position where he might have to find against a source of benefit. Says Shmuel and Moshe, I was a judge, I wasn't a king. The king, what did Shmuel say when they wanted a king? Do you remember how he tried to warn them off? What did he say? He will take your young boys into the army, and he will take your taxes, and he will... A king is a taker. If you're going to build institutional government is going to take. Here you've got a Shmuel. I'm a prophet, says Shmuel. I'm a giver. Not only didn't I ever take taxes from you for my own benefit, I didn't even take things from you when I was doing it for your benefit. Because I can't take, I don't want to take, because I'm a judge. And I'm going to have to find against you sometime. And therefore, I've got to be in a position where I'm the giver, not the taker. Look what you've lost, he says to them. You've lost a government that gives, and you've changed it for a government that takes, you stupid idiots. And sometimes you can only teach people what they've lost when they've lost it. You can't tell them before. You try it. But sometimes the point can only be made later on. It's now lost forever. You will never have a government again that gives. Your governments will always take, because that's the nature of that kind of government. That's what you wanted. You couldn't tolerate a government that gives. You couldn't tolerate that because it's independent of you. You couldn't tolerate a judge that is unbribable, because you've never done anything for him. Not only have you never done anything for him, you owe your lives to him. Every time God forgave you, it was because of a sacrifice. Who paid for the sacrifice? He did. Who knows who they're like? Not only is he not in your employ, you are in his employ. And nobody likes that. So instead you want a king who you employ. And you're willing to pay fortunes for the sense of control. I give to him, so I'm in control. Who created the expensive type of government that we have today? Who created that? We did. We like a president that we pay. We like judges that we pay. We like a Congress that we elect. We like people that we can put in and out of office. It gives us a sense of control. Fine, then pay for it. You want it, pay for it. It's going to be expensive. because that's how these governments work. And that was the choice that the people made, and Shmuel needs them to understand at this stage of his life, and at this stage of their evolution, he needs them to understand that absolutely. That they've exchanged leadership of giving for leadership of taking. And that is essentially how it needs to be in that structure. But it's not a move forward. It's not greater morality. It's not greater integrity. It's less so. It's more control for the people, less integrity for the people. That's the nature of control. The more you control, the less honesty there is, the more politics there is. The more control comes into the relationship, the more there has to be politics. And it's the same in every relationship. And next week we'll take this idea and we'll extend it a little further. We started that on the Wednesday morning ladies' share last Wednesday, and we'll extend it a little bit further next Monday night. But this concept of the counter forces of control and integrity, the control and the degree of politics and manipulation and expediency that comes in. When there is a take ethic, there is a control ethic. When there is a control ethic, there is a political environment. When there is a give ethic, there is not a control ethic. Where there is not a control ethic, there is not an environment of expediency and politics. And that's what the people of Israel had chosen. That was the exchange that they made. And that's Shmuel's address to them at this particular time. So we'll examine that more closely, we'll extend it to other forms of relationship, and then we'll interpret the chapter using that understanding in the process of doing so. Are there any questions before we close? Judy?
It sounds like then what he's telling them is just see it for yourself. There must be more to what he's saying than I told you.
There's, and it's not just I told you so in the sense of gaining that kind of satisfaction of the I told you so. It's the importance of knowing that there has been a major change. And it's the importance of knowing what one has lost, of at least valuing something retrospectively. And that's probably part of the reason that the way life is structured is that children lose parents. There is no way a child can fully appreciate a parent as long as the parent is alive. And that's why that year of mourning is so critical, because that's the time when a child learns to understand what the parent was. And it's a sad fact of life. And our challenge is to try and visualize loss. Because only in visualizing loss can you value possession. And unfortunately, sometimes we have to experience loss in order to be able to visualize it. So at least in retrospect, he wants them to understand. If they didn't understand the value of what they had, let them at least understand the value of what they had lost. And that's valuable, that's important. Yeah.
Is that why the five things he listed, the first two of which were those type of things, but the response that came back was only the latter three, not those first two? Is that sort of like a child being berated, not wanting to acknowledge the fact that?
Let's have a look at their response. He says in verse 5, God is the witness today and his anointed one. Ki lo matzatim biyadim u'ma, that you have found nothing in me. If you look at verse 4, sorry, vayomru, and they said, lo yashaktanu, they are answering on all of them. They start at the end. They say, you didn't oppress us. You didn't pressurize us. Ve'lo lokachtu miyad ishmu u'ma, nor did you take anything from us. So they do acknowledge, just in reverse order, the fact that nothing was taken. And he makes them repeat it. He says, "Does God is the witness that you have found nothing in my possession that belongs to you."
It looked like it was a reference to the wine test that he was talking about.
That
he's
talking about?
When he listed five, the last one was the wine test. He left us to blind my eyes with
them. That's bribery. He's saying, did I ever take a gift from you, va'alim einai boy, with the intention that that would blind my eye?
That's what that third one responded.
And they're saying on all of them, there's been no form of pressure. Oh, I see what you're saying. Meaning that you didn't take anything in bribery, but they're not talking about the borrowing. Let's have a look at that next week. A nice point. And you want to suggest that they're not too happy to acknowledge that degree of indebtedness. Okay, let's have a look. That's nice. That's a lovely thought. Yeah.
According to your premise that thou shalt not do harm to someone who's done good for you, Did David Kaczynski act immorally in turning in his brother to the Unabomber?
Yes.
I don't understand that. Because if that's the case, if he acted immorally by doing that, wouldn't we be in a situation where more killings would be going on?
If that was the only way to stop the killings, then it wouldn't be immoral.
If there was any other way to do it, that should have been chosen. And I don't know what came out of it in the case of whether that was ever discussed. Could have had somebody else do it.
Is that the same thing?
No. Iron hit the water. Iron hit the...
Says to his buddy, Jack, hey, my brother's the guy doing this, turn him in.
At least it's an acknowledgement. If he says, I can't do it. This judge who says, I can't sit on this case. Somebody else will. It's an acknowledgement that it's not proper for me to do. Just the acknowledgement of that impropriety is already a recognition of a moral indebtedness. There's something nasty about being the one to walk into the police. So I'm handling it. Looking at outcome, you're not looking at process. And we're living in an age that only values outcome. Bottom line, just tell me what it says at the bottom. I'm not reading through the whole thing. Just tell me what. Tell me how much it will give me. Tell me what's in it for me. We're only looking at outcome. Process is where morality is as well. The way you do things is just as important as what you do. The style with which you do it. The beauty with which you do it. Or the ugliness. The morality with which you do something. Two things can have the same outcome. One looks beautiful and one looks ugly. Two people can be sitting at a table eating the same food. Achieving the same nutrition, same outcomes. One looks like a pig and one looks like a mensch.
I agree with your dietary observation, but I don't see the difference. If you're the one who facilitates an outcome or if you're the one who does it directly, you're still bringing it about.
Levels of refinement and levels of coarseness. There are ways to do things that are more or less refined. You can eat with a knife and fork and you can eat with your hands. Back to the eating example. The outcome is identical. The process is different. One is more elegant.
But not immoral.
Well, there's a narrow line between elegance and morality. To impose inelegance on people. To impose ugliness on people. If one is eating on one's own, you can eat however you want. But if one's eating in a society, to impose inelegance on people is a question of morality. Fine morality. Morality is not just killing or not killing. Morality is not just stealing or not stealing. In the Torah we deal with very fine levels of morality. Very, very fine. Matters of style. Just the way you do something. The way one speaks to somebody. Sometimes a parent has to discipline a child as a way to do it. That's just a little less coarse than another way to do it. Same outcome maybe. But there's an acknowledgement of indebtedness. That's all. There's a sense of feeling. There's a humility in saying, I can't do it. And you'll say, why is it more moral? It's more moral not because of that relationship. You're right, in that relationship there's no difference. At the end of the day, same outcome. But it maintains a focus of examine everything in terms of what is my relationship with indebtedness. It means that I never stop thinking that way for a moment, not even with my own brother who's a murderer. Not that I'll have him carry on murdering. No, I have an obligation to society too. But I don't have to be the one to do it. Children turning in parents, and when they're encouraged to do so, very immoral society that encourages a child to turn in a parent. The Nazis did that. They rewarded children enormously for doing that.
I don't like your explanation because you're acknowledging subterfuge as being moral.
Why subterfuge?
You're saying that somebody can achieve a negative result by letting someone else do it for them. And that to me is in a way even more immoral is that someone being able to stand up and say, I recognize my brother is this killer, and I'm ready to finish this right.
I think what we need to do, and it's a very important discussion, perhaps we can carry on, I don't want to keep everybody, unless everybody's very interested in it, it comes on to a definition of what is morality.
Right, and you started it. You said it was immoral to do harm to someone who's done you good.
Absolutely. It is immoral to ignore an element of indebtedness in a relationship, and to cause that person or thing harm. What is the problem in the outcome if you're causing a thing, if you're dropping a stone into a well from which you've watered, from which you've drunk? Is the well suffering? No, it's not. Is anybody suffering? No, it's not. Why is it immoral? Because an action that is inelegant, an action that is self-centered, an action that shows no sensitivity to history, to past, to future, and to relationships of indebtedness, is an action which is immoral. The Torah does not only define morality in terms of its outcome. You can have an action which has no negative outcome and it's immoral. You can have an action which does have negative outcome and it's less immoral or not immoral at all. Outcome is only one of the elements of the decisions and the judgments of morality. Part of that we discussed last week, and we discussed only sections of it last week. But part of morality is in the purity and the refinement of the process, irrespective of its outcome. There are ways of doing things. When a surgeon is operating, or a coroner, or a pathologist is doing an autopsy, does it make any difference if he deals with the corpse in a reverent or irreverent way? Does anybody know the difference? Is that a matter of morality? I say yes. That is a matter of morality. It doesn't matter that the corpse is dead or under anesthetic. You're in the presence of a human body. You're in the presence of something and someone valuable. There are certain relationships. The process is as important as the outcome. So while in your example, and it's a very complex and a very important example to analyze, the outcome, if he were to ensure that this person was never found, that would be subterfuge. That would be endangering society because I have some private relationship with my brother. That would be unacceptable. If there was no other way to get this man stopped but to do it myself, sure. If I would have to shoot him, I would have to do that, if that's the only way I could stop him. But if there are other choices, I can keep my own humanity intact. For you to hand in my brother is less immoral than for me to hand in my brother. So if I came to you and said, there's no subterfuge, just for me to do it, it's just not nice. And I would prefer if you did it. I'm quite open about it. I'm not pretending I'm not involved. Everybody can know that I'm involved. I'm not doing the action. This is somebody I've benefited from. And it hurts me to have to do this. Just the acknowledgement of the hurt. The brazenness of not feeling hurt when one's doing something nasty, even if it's deserved. If a father beats a child and doesn't feel the pain, he has no right to touch the child. If a teacher disciplines a child and doesn't feel the pain, he has no right to discipline the child. If there's a way to do it without causing the pain, we'll do it. That's morality.
By the way, David Kaczynski was very pained by what he did.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah. Sorry?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
But you're not suggesting that he make an anonymous phone call to turn his brother in. But rather have someone do it, but it's acknowledged that he's the source of the information.
Sure. Imagine what impact that would have had if it was reported that way. The man's brother said he felt, as a brother, it would pain him too much. On the other hand, he has an obligation to society. He has facilitated my possibility of being able to convey this information. It's exactly the same outcome. One has a moral lesson to it, and one is absent of a moral lesson. Very, very fine morality. And not the way morality is normally judged or normally thought of. Very, very subtle. But if we don't protect those subtleties of morality, where does it stop? At what point do we start acknowledging? Everybody believes they're entitled. Did Hitler not believe he was doing the world a favor by ridding it of Jews? That doesn't make it moral. The outcome in his mind or the outcome in somebody else's mind, the only thing we can be absolutely sure of is that the way we do things, the intention with we do them, with which we do them, and the anticipated outcome. Those are the three things we have to watch for. But the process is incredibly important. Very, very important. Which is one of the reasons, by the way, which I did want to touch on just before we closed off, because I have been asked the question, and I think it's an important question to understand, and that is why it is that I'm particular about certain funny things, like people coming in late, which can happen, and I'm not worried about a person coming in late. What I am concerned about is a person coming in late at that side and taking a seat on this side. I'm concerned about a person coming in late and walking down through two rows and down the other row to find that seat, because that's the seat he wants. I'm concerned about a person coming in late and then going out and then coming back and then going out. I'm concerned about a person coming in late and then asking a question that's been covered 5 minutes before he walked in. I'm concerned about a person coming in late and going to help himself to a cup of tea.
before he sits down. All of things which used to happen in the early days of the shiur, they don't happen anymore, but they used to happen. All of those examples, every one of them, actually happened. Now, when one's learning Torah, one's not just learning about things, and one's not just learning some ancient text. One's learning a lot more than that. And I think there are two elements to it. The one element is back to the idea of process. It's not just outcome. There can be two shiurim, or two people can go to the same shiur and they can learn the same things. It's not just outcome. It's also the way we do things. We talked a week or two ago about a sense of occasion, about being able to judge what's the appropriate way to be in a particular situation. Some people say that Americans are very casual and very laid back. And I used to think that's true. But it isn't true. I've seen Americans in board meetings more formal and more particular and more courteous than anywhere in the world. I've seen Americans in Washington, in the presence of high political power, dressed meticulously, unbelievably courteous, unbelievably proper in every way, an absolute model to the world as how to behave in situations that are important. And therefore one must assume that when Americans, or anybody for that matter, South Africans are no different, or English, or anybody else, when they're casual and laid back, it's because they believe they're in a casual and laid back environment that doesn't demand anything of them. When they feel that an environment demands something of them, they respond remarkably well. There is nothing more awesome than the Torah. There is nothing more powerful, there's nothing more beautiful, there's nothing more spiritual than the Torah. And it's very hard to feel that if the people around one aren't sharing that feeling too. So when a person behaves inappropriately for a particular occasion, he is not only damaging his own capacity to draw on that occasion and to be elevated by it, but he's also impinging on other people's capacity to do so. And therefore the process, again, is just as important as the outcome. There's no formal dress code, that's not the issue. There are no formal rules or anything. Each person, as they feel. But each person needs to also understand that when you walk into a room, whether on time or late, you're impacting on the people around you. It's an unrealistic sense of modesty to think that you can be in a room and not be impacting. You are impacting. You're impacting positively. We can impact negatively. But we have impact in every interaction. We're having impact all the time. We're never neutral. We're either enriching an environment or we're impoverishing it. We're either contributing something to it or we're taking away something from it. And the way a person is in a particular occasion determines the degree to which he's able to contribute or to take away from it. And little things go to making those things important. And we know that in social circumstances, we know that in formal circumstances, we know that in business circumstances. People dress in the morning with in mind who they're going to be seeing that day. A person has an important meeting in a particular day, he dresses differently to if he's just going to be casually in his factory with his workers. He dresses differently, he understands that. But that has some kind of capacity. If it's an important meeting, he doesn't walk in late. If he does, he doesn't disturb or disrupt. It takes a while before he takes things in. What's important, what I'm trying to teach is that when we're learning the Torah, this is not just reading some ancient text. This is accessing the most deep and sharply focused, spiritual, sensitive, holy source of knowledge that there is in the world that we believe. That's why we're here. Why are you all giving up time in the middle of a week to come schlepping out here and to be sitting here? Why are you doing that? Because it's the greatest social occasion? No. Because I'm the most entertaining event in Los Angeles on a Monday night? No. There's only one reason. That's because you value the Torah. And part of that valuing, you will learn more and more from it as your relationship with it deepens and enhances. And part of what we're trying to do is not in any way impose any heavy kind of sense, not at all, but merely that as we develop and grow in our relationship with the Torah, so we develop and grow in the way we relate to it, in the process, not only in the outcome, in what we give, not only what we receive. Each one of you gives an enormous amount to this shiur, even when you don't say anything. By sitting there with an intelligent face, listening, probing, questioning, participating, coming up afterwards, sharing ideas with one another. Each one of you are an important contributor to a very precious process that takes place. And it's important that you don't undervalue your own importance. That you don't undervalue the centrality, the weightiness and the meaning of not only what you're taking from the shiur, but of also what you're contributing to it. Thank you very much.